This hour's top stories media projection show U.S. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden has won the crucial battleground state of Michigan, moving a step closer to win the presidency. Meanwhile, Biden says he is confident of winning the presidential race while his Republican rival questions the integrity of Tuesday's election. Also in the headlines, the UK records over 25,000 infections from the coronavirus as the British Parliament approves a month-long lockdown in England to fight the pandemic. Welcome to the program. U.S. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden says he is getting enough votes to win the 2020 race for the White House.
And now, after a long night of counting, it's clear that we're winning enough states to reach 270 electoral votes needed to win the presidency. I'm not here to declare that we've won, but I am here to report when the count is finished, we believe we will be the winners.
Biden said he also has the chance to win the crucial state of Pennsylvania. He added that he has the majority of popular votes all across the U.S. and that the majority will continue to grow. His comments come as U.S. media projections show Biden has secured 264 electoral votes while Trump has grabbed 214. A candidate needs to win 270 electoral ballots to become president, the latest key states to be won by Biden, who was Michigan. Well, Trump looks to have secured votes in Georgia and North Carolina. In Pennsylvania, Trump is leading over Biden, but the president's campaign says it is suing to halt vote count in the crucial state. U.S. President Trump claims there have been, quote, surprise ballot dumps in the state where he was leading his Democratic rival. Trump, of course, without offering any evidence, claimed his votes started to magically disappear after surprise ballots started being counted. The president's campaign has requested an immediate recount of votes in Wisconsin. It has also filed a lawsuit to halt the counting of votes in Michigan. Meanwhile, Joe Biden has pledged not to rest until the last vote is counted. Biden's campaign has said the Democratic contender is on track to win the race. This is while the president has already claimed victory.
I want to thank the American people for their tremendous support. Millions and millions of people voted for us tonight. And a very sad group of people is trying to disenfranchise that group of people. We were getting ready to win this election. Frankly, we did win this election. This is a major fraud in our nation. We want the law to be used in a proper manner. So we'll be going to the U.S. Supreme Court. We want all voting to stop. We don't want them to find any ballots at 4 o'clock in the morning and add them to the list, okay?
Earlier in a tweet, Trump also accused Democrats of trying to steal the vote. His threats have met with bipartisan condemnations Biden's campaign has described as outrageous. Trump's threat to try to stop the vote counting, warning that it has legal teams ready to resist that effort. Former Republican New Jersey Governor Chris Christie slammed Trump's claims as a bad strategy. Congressional Democrats also hit out at the president. Adam Schiff accused Trump of lying and acting like a despot. Final results from the U.S. presidential election may take days to be announced as a record number of Americans have cast their ballots via mail.
As expected, Election Day in the United States ended with no clear winner in the presidential election. Early returns seem to give Donald Trump the key Electoral College swing states of Florida and Ohio, as the widely touted blue wave for Democratic challenger Joe Biden never materialized. However, a record number of mail-in votes means that counting could drag on for days, especially if vote totals remain close. The vote could even drag on for weeks, with hundreds of election-related lawsuits filed even before the polls opened. A highly controversial president and a highly controversial election now seem set for a highly controversial tabulation process.
I'm just kind of tired of it all. We've been in this election for 2 years, basically. And I've heard from a lot of friends that just, they're just kind of scared and worried about, chaos, worried about what the process is going to look like. Seems like a lot of things leading up to this has caused a lot of people to worry and be distrustful of, if the votes are going to be all counted and everything, so.
Polls showed that 3 out of 4 Americans were worried about violence on Election Day, probably because the mainstream media had talked about it constantly for months. But many major cities took extreme security measures, and the massive pitched battles between right-wing militias, anarchist groups, and cops never really occurred. However, nationwide rallies are set for the day after the election, and the lack of a clear victor could mean that America continues to see unprecedented protests and social unrest in 2020.
I think there's going to be violence. Doesn't matter who wins. So, if Trump wins, we got all the Black Lives Matter who are going to, come out here and protest. But if, Trump doesn't win, we got all the, white supremacists or the Trump supporters coming out.
The U.S. appears headed for a drawn-out election dispute like in the year 2000, which will be decided by lawyers and judges and not voters. As is the case with most of this exceptional year of 2020, the only certainty appears to be uncertainty. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Attorney and former diplomat Michael Springman says previous riots regarding race in America shows that the U.S. politics and its people are increasingly polarized.
They have had race riots, looting, and general insurrection in the state of Washington, Oregon, Pennsylvania, and here in Washington, D.C. over the last couple of months. As Sam Lozanian had remarked, the issue is, will people accept the results of the election? And if it goes the wrong way, what's going to happen? And piles of bricks and things like this indicate that they're getting ready to contest the election in any way, shape, or form that they can manage. Just last night in D.C., they had a couple of, they were termed scuffles by the Washington Post, between demonstrators and the Washington Police Department. So I think that given what's happened in the past and the fact that they've resisted Trump for 4 years, I believe that if the election shows that Trump eventually squeaks out a win, you will find a lot of people out in the streets complaining about it violently.
Analyst Margaret Flower says U.S. President Trump is very good at throwing bold statements, and it would not be surprising if he pushes for legal challenges to the election results.
This is consistent with his what he's been saying even through the 2016 election. He said he wouldn't accept the results if he lost, and he's very good at throwing these bold statements out there that get people really worked up. But the reality is, he doesn't control the election system, and we do have a system, and people are taking the time to go through, making sure that the votes are counted and use a process. But that said, it wouldn't be surprising if there are legal challenges to the result. And, people here are pretty much realizing that it's going to take some time before we actually know the outcome of this election. I think, if you look at the polls, it was predicted there was a 90% chance that Biden would win this election and only a 10% chance that Trump would. And there are, because of Trump's statements, it has gotten certain segments of the population upset, and organizations, including labor unions, have been saying that if the, if Biden wins and President Trump tries to fight that victory, then they'll go into the streets and even possibly organize a general strike. So there are people that are protesting, but I think in general, there's a growing realization that no matter who wins this election, given the pandemic and the recession, economic recession, and the climate crisis and so many other crises, police violence that we're facing, that there's going to be a lot of protests in the coming months continuing, you know, in the United States.
Europe is struggling to contain the coronavirus pandemic as the numbers of fatalities and infections continue to rise across the continent. Italy has reported more than 30,000 new cases and 352 deaths in 24 hours. The country has ordered gyms, cinemas, and theaters shut and imposed a 6 p.m. working time restriction on restaurants and cafes. Other measures include a nighttime curfew until December the 3rd. Toughest curbs have been introduced in the country's northern Lombardy region. The UK recorded 492 new fatalities and over 25,000 infections. British lawmakers have approved a month-long lockdown in England that starts from Thursday. A senior cabinet minister has indicated that the lockdown could last longer. Prime Minister Johnson rejected the comment.
These measures, these autumn measures to combat the surge, will expire automatically, Mr. Speaker, on December the 2nd. And we will then, I hope very much, be able to get this country going again, to get businesses, to get shops open again in the run-up to Christmas. But that depends on us all doing our bit now to make sure that we get the R done. I've no doubt that we can.
Elsewhere in France, over 40,000 daily cases were reported, pushing the total infections to over 1.5 million. The total death toll in the country has risen to over 38,000. Russia announced a record daily number of infections with nearly 20,000 new cases and 389 deaths in 24 hours. Poland registered over 24,000 new infections and 373 deaths, both of which are new records. The Polish government says most shopping malls, as well as theaters, cinemas, and museums, will be closed to combat the pandemic. The European Union has condemned Turkey's recent announcement to expand its seismic survey in the eastern Mediterranean. In a statement, EU foreign policy chief Joseph Borrell described Turkey's extension of gas exploration mission in the disputed waters as deeply regrettable. Borrell warned that such a move will create more tension and distrust in the region. He also called for a dialogue in good faith to reduce tensions. Greece and Turkey have been at odds since August, when Ankara sent a research ship to the eastern Mediterranean. Athens then called it a violation of Greek territorial waters and requested the EU to impose sanctions on Turkey. The EU will decide on whether to take anti-Turkey measures in its next summit. Next month. UK families calling for justice have held a rally asking for accountability and justice over the country's deaths in police custody. Our correspondent there, Richard Sudan, reports.
Deaths in custody has been and remains a serious issue of concern for many in Britain in 2020, with countless individuals continuing to die in deeply suspicious circumstances while in the custody of the police. This year, the United Friends and Family Campaign, UFFC, launched their yearly March for Justice, with this year's event taking place online due to the current COVID-19 restrictions. Despite the calls for justice continuing over many decades, police accountability and real change remain as elusive as ever, especially for black communities, which, according to the facts, are more likely to fall victim to police violence.
I think that certainly the use of force, as described by the Metropolitan Police, the extent to which they use force when arresting black people, was six times more likely. And of course, that because we're more likely to suffer mental ill health, that is always another recurring feature, overwhelming and disproportionate force, when actually what somebody needs is a caring environment, yes, restrained, but they're not criminal, they're just mentally ill. And so these are the kind of recurring factors that we see evidenced in black deaths in custody.
I'm the twin of Leon Patterson, who died in police custody in Denton in 1992, 27th of November. He was arrested on suspicion of stealing a till, which was then proved not to be the case. He was held in police custody for 6 days and was found dead in the cell on the 27th of November. The outline that I got from the chief superintendent was that Leon basically beat himself to death by throwing himself around the cell.
3 decades on from Leon Patterson's death, and like so many cases, no officer has ever been charged or brought to justice.
When we did remove the sheet from the body, I mean, it was a bit of a to-ing and fro-ing to remove the sheet, because he went, you can't touch it. They had the morgue attendants trying to hold down the sheet, and the officer just kept standing behind me saying, you do know this is all self-inflicted, you do know that he did this to himself. And that's when we turned him over and saw all the bruises on the back and down his legs. So to keep saying that this is all self-inflicted was mute.
The justification for black deaths in custody and the rationale behind it, you know, is all developed within the sort of racist context of a white privilege that assumes that white people can never be guilty of any sin when it comes to inflicting violence against black people. And that's an attitude and a lived experience we've lived with since we were on the plantations, you know, way back in the 17th century. And it's continued from that day right up until this day.
Despite the calls for accountability and justice, far too many people fall victim to police violence, where far from upholding the law, they often break it with deadly consequences, knowing that they operate under a different set of laws which they themselves exist to uphold.
Deaths in custody remains an issue disproportionately affecting Britain's black communities. Despite promises to enact reforms, many argue that Britain's police remains institutionally racist. Under the current government and with racism on the rise, this situation could get a lot worse. Richard Sudam, London.
Palestinian journalists have held a sit-in rally in Gaza to mark the International Day to End Impunity for Crimes Against Journalists. Israeli forces have killed and injured hundreds of Palestinian journalists over the past 2 decades without being held accountable for their crimes. Ashraf Shannon reports.
Palestinian journalists in the blockaded Gaza Strip have marked the International Day to End Impunity for Crimes Against Journalists in front of the United Nations office. Journalists demanded an end to Israel's impunity and that Israeli leaders be held accountable for their crimes against Palestinian journalists. The Palestinian Journalist Syndicate handed a memorandum to UN officials demanding protection for Palestinian journalists. Since the beginning of 2019, Israeli forces carried out hundreds of attacks against Palestinian journalists.
Attacks against journalists are systematic and take place almost every day. Israeli forces target Palestinian journalists in almost every protest or event. Since last year alone, Palestinian journalists were attacked over 750 times.
According to human rights organizations, Israeli forces killed 43 journalists over the last 20 years. Additionally, hundreds of journalists were seriously injured, sustaining permanent disabilities that will probably accompany them throughout their lives.
The United Nations must come out of its silence and protect Palestinian journalists who are constantly subjected to Israeli crimes. Israeli forces have killed dozens of Palestinian journalists and injured hundreds more while others are still in Israeli custody. We call on the United Nations to help bring Israeli criminals to justice at the International Criminal Court.
During the Great March of Return rallies, Israeli forces shot and killed 2 Palestinian journalists and injured hundreds while they were covering the peaceful action. Palestinian journalists say they work hard to avoid being part of the story themselves.
We are coming under deliberate and premeditated attacks by Israeli soldiers during the peaceful rallies. Israeli forces killed 2 of my colleagues and injured hundreds, and I was injured twice while covering the protests. Some of the journalists sustained permanent disabilities.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye.
Israeli attacks against journalists have increased in recent years. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of Israel. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
And that's it with international news.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
According to a recent survey of California residents conducted by researchers at the University of California, Davis, fears about lawlessness and government instability drove many Americans to purchase firearms. Nicole Kravitz-Wirtz, the lead author of the study, said people who said they had bought guns this year, two-thirds expressed worry about lawlessness and close to a half worried about prisoners being released. Half also cited worry about the government going too far. In the past, demand for guns in the United States has typically spiked in reaction to events that are seen as increasing the risk of new gun control laws, including major mass shootings, and the chance that a Democrat might win the White House. Gun owners say this year, months of sustained demand for firearms has resulted in continuing shortages as well as rising prices. Gun violence prevention advocates said the sustained surge in gun sales was deeply troubling and could continue to an increase in domestic violence, suicide, and children accidentally shooting themselves or other people with adult guns. According to an estimate from researchers at the University of California at Davis, an increase in gun purchases in just the first 3 months of the coronavirus pandemic was associated with a nearly 8% increase in firearm violence in the United States. We now present you an article written by Lois Beckett. The piece is titled, Report Says Americans Bought Record 17 Million Guns in Year of Unrest. The article was taken from the Guardian newspaper. Please stay with us for more of Lois Beckett's article. According to estimates from a firearms analytics company, Americans have bought nearly 17 million guns so far in 2020, more than in any other year. Gun sales across the United States first jumped in the spring, driven by fears about the coronavirus pandemic, and spiked even higher in the summer during massive racial justice protests across the country, prompted by police killing of black Americans. Jürgen Brauer, the chief economist of Small Arms Analytics, which produces widely cited estimates of U.S. gun sales, said, by August, we had exceeded last year's total. By September, we exceeded the highest total ever. Jürgen Brauer said the estimated number of guns sold in the United States through the end of September 2020 is not only more than last year, it's more than any full year in the last 20 years we have records for. He said the previous record for estimated firearms sold in a single year was 16.6 million in 2016, when Hillary Clinton ran for president against Donald Trump and endorsed a strong gun control platform. The spike in gun sales comes amid rising tensions and intense political polarization. According to the Wall Street Journal, citing the current unrest, Walmart removed guns and ammunition from display in stores this week as a precaution against theft if stores are robbed. The retailer did not confirm when firearms and ammunition will be put back on display, but said that customers could continue to buy guns and ammunition by request. Walmart has already restricted the types of guns and ammunition it sells in the wake of mass shootings and other instances of gun violence, Last year, the company said it would no longer sell ammunition for military-style rifles after a white nationalist terror attack targeting Latino families at a Walmart store in El Paso, Texas. Jürgen Brauer, the firearms analyst, said the increase in gun sales appears to be primarily driven by more purchases of handguns, though Americans were also buying more rifles and other long guns. Whilst there is no hard data on how many Americans bought a gun for the first time this year, advocates across the political spectrum say they believe that many of the guns sold in 2020 went to new gun owners. According to a recent survey of California residents conducted by researchers at the University of California, Davis, fears about lawlessness and government instability drove many people to purchase firearms. Nicole Kravitz-Wirtz, the leading author of the study, said people who said they had bought guns this year, two-thirds expressed worry about lawlessness and close to half worried about prisoners being released. Half also cited worry about the government going too far. In the past, demand for guns in the United States has typically spiked in reaction to events that are seen as increasing the risk of new gun control laws, including major mass shootings and the chance that a Democrat might win the White House. Former U.S. President Barack Obama was known as America's greatest gun salesman. Whilst firearm sales initially slumped under Donald Trump, whose election victory was backed by more than $30 million from the National Rifle Association, the NRA. Gun owners say this year, months of sustained demand for firearms has resulted in continuing shortages as well as rising prices. Chuck Rossi, one of the founders of Open Source Defense, a gun rights group created by current and former tech workers, said, "I don't think there's been anything like it in my 30 years of being involved in firearms." He added, "There is no inventory, there are no guns to buy, there is no ammunition to buy. There continue to this day to be lines at gun counters with empty shelves." Gun violence prevention advocates said the sustained surge in gun sales was deeply worrying and could contribute to an increase in domestic violence, suicide, and children accidentally shooting themselves or other people with adult guns. According to an estimate from researchers at the University of California at Davis, an increase in gun purchases just the first 3 months of the coronavirus pandemic was associated with nearly 8% increase in firearms violence in the United States. The researchers found that increase translated into an estimated 776 additional shooting injuries in the United States from March through to May. States that had lower levels of violent crime pre-COVID-19 pandemic saw a stronger connection between additional gun purchases and more gun violence. Robin Thomas, the executive director of the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, said the gun industry thrives in a culture of fear. Their business model is based on a model of leveraging people's fear in order to buy these products, and they never talk about the risk of owning a gun. Kareem Shaya, a gun rights advocate and another founder of Open Source Defense, which has organized dozens of video training sessions for first-time gun owners this year, said, "The common threat is just uncertainty," adding, "A feeling of, if nobody else is going to be able to take care of me, push comes to shove, I want to be able to take care of myself." Meanwhile, the report says there are grave concerns in the United States about the possibility of a rise in violence on Election Day, 3rd of November, and the period immediately after it. As cited in a report by the Washington Post, Olivia Catby Smith, the co-chair of the Democratic Socialists of America in Portland, Oregon, said, "The right is not going to give up their power unless they feel threatened." She added, "People are opening up to the idea that a riot is the language of the unheard. Property destruction is not violence." Extremist activists on both sides of the political spectrum could face off in Portland, Oregon, which has been a scene of protest and a symbol of divide within America. Drew Miller, a founder of the Building Network of members-only survivalist camps, said, could the election devolve into civil war? Unlikely. Adding, but look at the First World War. Some worthless, low-level archduke gets assassinated and things escalate out of control. I've got people who are concerned that all it would take is a close election and some cheating. With President Donald Trump's encouragement of hate in his rallies and a spike in gun sales, as well as a rise in online chatter about civil war in the United States, concerns have grown that the situation could easily get out of hand on 3rd of November. Lisa Kaplan, the chief executive of the Aletheia Group, a Washington company that tracks disinformation efforts, said, we're talking about violence in U.S. elections, and that's insane. She added, this is a real threat, and we have seen increased confidence amongst the militias. Clashes between right-wing militias and Antifa activists have recently grown amid the nation's protests against police brutality and racial injustice. The Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, a non-profit organization that researches political violence and has tracked more than 80 extremist groups in recent months, said militia groups and other armed non-state actors pose a serious threat to the safety and security of American voters. The project's report said Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Oregon are at high risk of increased militia activity in the election and post-election period. Earlier this month, Democratic nominee Joe Biden described the situation as dangerous in a speech in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. The former Vice President, Joe Biden, said, as I look across America today, I'm concerned. He added, the country is in a dangerous place. Our trust in each other is ebbing. Hope seems elusive. Meanwhile, protesters in the U.S. state of Washington have set American flags on fire as tensions boiled over into unrest following a vigil for an African-American man who was shot and killed by police in Washington state. Hundreds of people attended a vigil on Friday night, 30th of October, for Kevin Peterson, who was fatally shot by Clark County Sheriff's Office deputies the night before in a city in southwestern Washington state. Police offered unclear accounts on Friday of what led the deputies to shoot and kill Peterson, a 21-year-old. The incident happened along Highway 99. At an abrupt press conference, Sheriff Chuck Atkins claimed Peterson was under a drug-related investigation and fired a gun at deputies who chased him. A separate team of police officers investigating the shooting did not mention the suspect opening fire on police officers. At the vigil, some protesters held signs reading, "Honk for Black Lives," "White Silence is Violence," and "Scream His Name." Nearby, tensions flared between left and right-wing protesters. Some armed demonstrators gathered near a building they told reporters they were protecting. Hundreds of protesters later marched through downtown Vancouver as crowds began to disperse from the site of the vigil. The protesters burnt U.S. flags. Federal law enforcement officers in riot gear surrounded the building and warned the demonstrators that they would be arrested if caught trespassing on federal property. Authorities declared an unlawful assembly and ordered protesters to disperse. At least one person was arrested by police. Police involved shooting and killing of black men in the hands of white police officers has led to massive protests across the country in recent years, giving birth to the Black Lives Matter movement. The killing of George Floyd by a white police officer in Minneapolis, Minnesota, in May of this year, triggered months of anti-racism protests across major U.S. cities.
food for thought.
Hello everyone, and as food for thought today, we present you a hadith or narration from Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, of how best to educate your children so that they will be successful in this world and in the afterlife. Teach your children three habits: to love your Prophet, to love his Ahlul Bayt, and to recite the Holy Quran. Because the carrier of the Quran will be in the shade of Allah along with his Prophet and the chosen ones, that is, the Ahlul Bayt, on the day when there will be no shade except that of Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, worship of free men. although the promises of divine reward and punishment are all true, and his reward is very valuable and his chastisement is very painful, there are some high-minded freemen who do not see anything save God, and do not seek anything other than God. And the measures of their heart is full of love and kindness. Brothers and sisters, yes, there are, you know, verses in Quran and in the Ahadith of Ahlul Bayt where they have discussed the chastisement and the punishment for carrying out a misdeed or a sin. And there are also verses in Quran and the traditions of Ahlul Bayt mentioning the reward in the hereafter in the form and shape of Jannah and heaven and, you know, paradise for a believer and those who do good act and so on and so forth. These things are in their own place of importance. But there are some people who worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala because they love Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because they just don't see anybody else being worthy of being worshipped. They're looking beyond rewards and punishment. Their motive of observing God's command is only love mingled with his cognition and knowing. So their ma'rifat compels them to obey Allah and to worship Allah and to pray to Allah. And this is something very special. This is the worship of a free man. And we're going to bring to you a hadith after the break, which is going to make it even more clear for you what we're trying to say here. Welcome back, dear listeners. We're talking about, you know, the concept of reward and punishment and all of those things being very legit. But there are some people who observe Islam. They submit to Islam. They submit to Allah. They worship Allah. Why? Not out of fear, not out of temptation, no fear of hell, no temptation of paradise. Rather, their worship is because they love Allah. They recognize Allah. Their in-depth recognition, ma'rifat, it creates this feeling inside them to worship Allah and submit to Allah. Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam, the sixth infallible Imam, has said, worshippers fall into three groups. Those who worship Allah for the fear of hell. This is the worship of slaves. Then the second is those who worship Allah for his reward. This is the worship of mercenaries or traders. The third one is those who worship Allah out of love and affection for him. This is the worship of free men. Brothers and sisters, it's essential for us to strive and struggle to become one of those free men and women, those free beings who worship Allah for who Allah is, who have so much in-depth recognition of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that they feel compelled to worship him. It is still good to keep worshiping out of the fear of hell and the temptation of paradise. There's, you know, so to speak, nothing wrong with it. You know, it's a beginner's level, right? But really, that ideal state that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants us to see in is the worship of a free man. This is what we are expected to achieve. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
A new stab in the back. That's how the Palestinians describe the agreement between Sudan's transitional government and Israel. Sudan and Israel have agreed to normalize ties. Sudan followed suit after Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates normalized ties with Israel earlier this year. The United States brokered the agreement between the two parties, making Sudan the fifth Arab country to establish relations with Israel. The deal was sealed apparently in a phone call with US President Donald Trump, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and Transitional Council head Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. The leaders agreed to the normalization of relations between Sudan and Israel and to end the state of belligerence between their nations, said the joint statement by the United States, Israel, and Sudan. An official signing ceremony is expected to be held at the White House in the weeks to come. Israel and Sudan agreed to normalize relations in conjunction with U.S. President Donald Trump signing a decree removing Sudan from the list of countries sponsoring terrorism. Sudan has for years had financial troubles, and after former President Omar al-Bashir was ousted in a popular uprising against him, the transitional government thought the U.S. would finally take the country off its blacklist. But it has been reported that Sudan was under pressure by the US, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia to normalize with Israel if it wants to alleviate its financial burdens. Finally, Sudan normalizes ties with Israel only 2 weeks after the US took it off its blacklist. But seeing that this is what the country had to do to achieve what seems like financial freedom, many people in Sudan are not happy about this. Sudanese protesters have taken to the streets to condemn the current government's decision to forge diplomatic relations with Israel. Sudan's National Ummah Party, NUP, the largest political party there, rejected any normalization with Israel. The NUP's leader, Sadiq al-Mahdi, said the transitional government, which is to remain in office until elections in 2022, has no mandate to make decisions on such controversial issues. The NUP's leader, Sadiq al-Mahdi, withdrew from a government-organized religious conference in protest against the normalization announcement. He said, "This statement contradicts the deal, the Sudanese national law, and contributes to the elimination of the peace project in the Middle East and to preparing for the ignition of a new war." Sadiq al-Mahdi carries huge political and popular weight as he was the Prime Minister of Sudan three times and also known as the country's last elected premier. Other Sudanese political parties also lined up to declare their rejection of the normalization agreement, stressing they are going to form a front to oppose the move. The Sudanese Ba'ath Party, the Sudanese Communist Party, National Consensus Forces NCF, a coalition of political parties, the National Democratic Alliance NDA, the Forces of Freedom and Change FFC Alliance, the Popular Congress Party, as well as Sudan Change Now Political Movement, stated that they are fiercely against any relationship between Khartoum and Tel Aviv. Sudan has been tense for a while after a popular uprising last year led the military to overthrow the longtime autocrat Omar al-Bashir. The transitional government has promised elections as soon as 2022. Al-Mahdi, who heads the National Ummah Party, was overthrown in a 1989 coup that brought al-Bashir to power. His party is allied with the movement that led to protests against al-Bashir. The normalization announcement by Sudan came as a surprise to many, as the African country has long been a supporter of the Palestinians and their cause. In 1948, a detachment of troops from Sudan were among the Arab armies Israel fought against when it was incepted onto Palestinian lands. When Sudan gained independence in 1956 from British rule, Israel secretly aided separatist rebels in southern Sudan. Sudan sent a contingent of troops to aid Egyptian forces in the 1967 war with Israel. Sudan hosted a landmark Arab League conference on August 29, 1967. That day, eight Arab countries approved the Khartoum resolution, known as the Three No's Resolution: no peace with Israel, no recognition of Israel, and no negotiations with Israel. In the 1970s, Israeli pilots operating from Uganda and Kenya flew arms to the rebel forces of southern Sudan once again. Fast forward to the years leading up to the 2011 independence of South Sudan from Sudan, and even decades before that, Israeli military officials were meeting with rebels in Israel. In secret, visits to Israel, southern Sudanese rebels received financial and military aid from Tel Aviv. It is no wonder that Israel was one of the first to recognize South Sudan after its independence. Israel recognized South Sudan on July 10, 2011, a day after South Sudan became an independent state. On July 15th of that year, South Sudan announced that it intended to have full diplomatic relations with Israel. On July 28, 2011, Israel announced that it had established full diplomatic ties with South Sudan. Sudan's agreement to normalize with Israel seems to be built upon political pressure that has divided the country and created political tension and turmoil for decades. It is also clear that U.S. President Donald Trump is the entity enforcing the controversial normalization deals. This leaves one wondering, will normalization with Israel hold after the U.S. election on November 3, or is Trump sowing the seeds of further destabilization in a country and region that has witnessed far too much of it?
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
A new study found more than 80% of 200 patients hospitalized in Spain with COVID-19 had low levels of vitamin D. The study, which was published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism, found that the majority of patients being treated for COVID-19 at a hospital in the northern city of Santander suffered from a deficiency of vitamin D. Researchers at the University of Cantabria determined that just 82% of the 216 patients had inadequate levels, compared to around 47% of people in a control group who didn't have the virus. The vitamin, which promotes healthy bones and supports immune system functions, is produced by the body naturally when it's exposed to sunlight, though it can also be obtained from eating foods such as fatty fish, egg yolk, mushrooms, and cheese. Patients with deficiencies of the sunlight vitamin in the study were also more likely to have hypertension and heart disease, as well as experience longer hospital stays. We're prepared for you an article written by news.sky.com and the New York Post. The piece is titled, "Antibodies Fall Rapidly After Coronavirus Infection, 80% of COVID-19 Patients Vitamin D Deficient." Please stay with us for more of news.sky.com and the New York Post article. Researchers are saying levels of protective antibodies in people wane quite rapidly after coronavirus infection. Antibodies are a key part of our immune defenses and stop the virus from getting inside the body's cells. The Imperial College London team found the number of people testing positive for antibodies has fallen by 26% between June and September. They said immunity appears to be fading and there is a risk of catching the coronavirus multiple times. More than 350,000 people in England have taken an antibody test as part of the REACT2 study so far. In the first round of testing at the end of June and the beginning of July, about 60 in 1,000 people had detectable antibodies. But in the later set of tests in September, only 44 per 1,000 people were positive. It suggested that the number of people with antibodies fell by more than a quarter between summer and autumn. Professor Helen Ward, one of the researchers, said, "Immunity is waning quite rapidly. We're only 3 months after our first round of tests, and we're already showing a 26% decline in antibodies. The fall was greater in those over the age of 65 compared with younger age groups, and in those without symptoms compared with those with full-blown COVID-19. The number of healthcare workers with antibodies remained relatively high, which the researchers suggest may be due to regular exposure to the virus. Antibodies stick to the surface of the coronavirus to stop it invading our body cells and attract the rest of the immune system. Exactly what the antibody drop means for immunity is still uncertain. There are other parts of the immune system, such as T cells, which may also play a role. However, the researchers warn antibodies tend to be highly predictive of who is protected. Professor Wendy Barclay says, "We can see the antibodies and we can see them declining, and we know antibodies on their own are quite protective." Professor Barclay added, "On the balance of evidence, I would say it would look as if immunity declines away at the same rate as antibodies decline away, and that this is an indication of waning immunity. There are four other human coronaviruses which we catch multiple times in our lives. They cause common cold symptoms, and we can be reinfected every 6 to 12 months. There have been very few confirmed cases of people getting COVID twice. However, the researchers warn this may be due to immunity only just starting to fade since the peak infection rates of March and April. The hope is the second infection will be milder than the first, even if immunity does decline, as the body should have an immune memory of the first encounter and know how to fight back." The researchers said their findings do not scupper hopes of a vaccine